OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/wallstreet.
Today on the WSJ Media Mix podcast, we speak with NPR CEO Jarl Mohn about the future of the podcast industry, the role of public media in the news business, and how NPR thinks about giant platforms like Facebook.
Welcome to the WSJ Media Mix podcast, bringing you interviews and analysis with people that matter in the fast-changing media business.
Hello and welcome to the WSJ Media Mix podcast. I'm Steven Perlberg. I'm here as always with my colleague Jack Marshall. What's up?
Not much, Steve. I'm doing good.
So how do you think this podcast has gone over the past few months? It's gone pretty well, right?
I would say so.
All right. Well, we have someone with us today who's going to really be the judge of our podcasting chops, because we are joined by Jarl Mohn. He's the president and CEO of NPR. We haven't done really a podcast on podcasting yet, a podcast on radio. So
it's very meta.
It is very meta. We get into meta media topics often on this podcast, but I think this will be the most meta one we've had so far. So Jarl's had a long career in media. We were just speaking beforehand. He was a radio disc jockey, TV executive at E! And MTV, and for the past about 2 years, you've been at NPR. So I guess maybe the best place to start is sort of the... The evolution of audio and podcasting. We're experimenting it here. So what has that been like over the past few years? You really, it sounds like, joined kind of right before Serial and this great big podcasting boom that we're all enjoying. So what has that been like, and how has your business changed in the past few years as podcasting has boomed?
Well, there's a lot to that question. NPR has been involved in podcasting for a much longer period of time. I think the launch of Serial and the incredible success that Ira Glass and This American Life have had with Serial, I think, really brought it to the forefront in a lot of people's minds. But we've been doing podcasts at NPR for 10 years before, and, you know, doing some really great work. It's exciting. I think it's remarkably exciting for many, many reasons. One, it's a great business. I think there's an incredible renaissance of creativity and storytelling across the board in our organization and a lot of organizations. I think people are doing really remarkable work. I think the intimacy of audio and the intimacy of storytelling, and I think many people are listening with earbuds, and there's something, I think, even more oddly, you know, from a tech standpoint, personal.
You're like
about
in
that.
Your, in someone's
in
head.
In your head. Yeah. In your head. I mean, it sounds a little weird, but I really think there's something to that. And I think also just from on a broader scale, from the business, all the businesses that we're in, including the network radio business, we think podcasting is just a wonderful adjunct to that. And we think it's a wonderful entry point for a lot of people to discover our way of storytelling and the kinds of things we do. So we're excited, everything from a creative viewpoint to the business viewpoint. We just think it's a wonderful thing that's happening.
So from an audience perspective, to what extent do you think that's additive versus sort of replacing people that may be listening to NPR on radio, for example?
Well, we know it's additive because, you know, we get significant data across all of our platforms. And the most recent month, November, we can look at any one of the platforms we're on. And it's not just podcasting in the network. It has to do with NPR.org. We have three apps. We have the NPR News app. We have NPR One. We have NPR Music. And when we look at, you know, the amount of usage that we have, how many people download the app, how many people are using it on a regular basis, how often they're using it, how long they're listening, we're seeing great growth across everything. So on the network, you know, our primary business, our legacy business, if you will, we're up 40% year over year, which is terrific. Some of that, of course, I think is election related, but it's significantly more than our counterparts in commercial news radio. NPR.org last February. I imagine people are, their eyes are glazing over with all these numbers, so I'll try to restrain myself. But in February, we had a record month of 36 million uniques. November, we were at 58.1 million uniques on NPR.1. And you've seen the stats on the podcasting. The PodTrack numbers that we get, we had 69 million downloads in November, 9.2 million unique. So every one of the platforms, we're seeing incredible growth. So I think it's additive. My theory all along has been We create content, we create programming, we create stuff that people listen to if we do a good job across all the platforms, and each one is different. We should do well with all of them.
And you guys are not unlike other sort of legacy media businesses, maybe like newspapers or cable, that are trying to, you know, keep this sort of legacy business going and but also make sure that you're, you know, positioning yourself for the digital future and things like that. But what's interesting is, I think, like with the podcasting boom, are any of your member stations, I mean, to what extent do they see you guys pushing into digital, pushing into podcast, and say, hey, you know, what about us? I mean, this is does it take away from any of the stuff that they might be doing, or are they worried about their audiences maybe migrating?
I think a couple of years ago, that was a huge issue. And I think the theory that we were espousing at the time, that if we do great content, we at the network and the stations on the local level, that everything's going to be fine. It's very different than cable. It's very different than the newspaper business. As you know, the newspaper business has certain economics of printing on paper and distributing it by human beings to people's doorstep. And the cable business also, you're talking about something where people have to pay a monthly fee. So you have all this cord cutting that goes on. Radio is it's a free service. And 93% of adults listened in the last 7 days. So, I mean, people still use it. It's very different in that regard. But I do think there was a great fear a couple of years ago. A number of things have happened, and this year is a great example in terms of we've been able to demonstrate that it hasn't hurt their business. We've grown this remarkable business at the same time that their audience, our audience and their audience, is growing. And then some really interesting little experiments that we've just started doing in the podcasts. We're telling people, if you really love public radio and you're listening to this podcast, why don't you make a contribution to your member station? Tell them you heard about it on this NPR podcast. And they're doing it. So the stations love that. If you had asked this question 2 years ago, I probably would have given you a different answer and said, this is what we hope to prove. I think we've done that.
Do you think that trend will continue as radio audiences perhaps age and younger audiences are perhaps sort of gravitating more towards digital distribution? Is that sort of a short to medium term trend? How does that sort of play out over the next like 20 or 30 years, for example?
I'll predict it to the day, if you wish.
That's what we like to do here. What's your 30-year media outlook?
We're fine. We get it to the day. Well, we may narrow it down to the month. My belief is that it's not a binary decision of legacy media, digital media, radio, podcast, apps. People are very complex, and they consume media in all sorts of methodologies. They may start reading newspaper less frequently or magazines less frequently. Yet, you know, magazines still is, I think, really an interesting business. Some are doing it on their podcast. Some are doing certainly the smartphone is the platform of choice these days. Radio is still, even with millennials, I mean, there's this mythology that millennials don't listen to the radio. We have people in our organization that deeply believe that. If you look at the Nielsen data, last week, 92% of American millennials, 92% listen to broadcast radio. They still use the medium.
Is that like the coastal elite not really realizing that millennials are driving in the middle of the country and listening to radio and NPR? Is that like what do you think?
It's not just the middle of the country. In Los Angeles, I mean, New York, this is the interesting thing.
New York is the anomaly in that respect.
New York is the anomaly.
Well, I think it is that way in a lot of respects, probably.
But I mean, everywhere I go, and I travel a lot, I just drove across the country. I spent 3 weeks and I drove from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles, and I visited 21 cities. I visited 32 of our member stations. I ate at a lot of Cracker Barrels. And I had a lot of barbecue. Some cities you'd be shocked to have traffic problems. Austin, Texas, a great example. Really great, progressive, interesting, hip town. But one of their biggest issues is traffic. The traffic there in many ways is almost as bad as, if not as bad as, you know, my hometown of Los Angeles. So you're stuck in your car a lot, and people do listen to the radio a lot. And it's not an either or. People love podcasts. It's a great medium. Radio can be a great medium. People are using Spotify and Pandora and podcasts. And I mean, it's that's the great thing about technology. It's all this choice. So in 30 years, who the hell knows? I mean, I don't know that anybody 30 years, or 20, or even 10. But I do think ultimately it's something I believe. And I've been in, I hate to say it, this is going to sound awful, but I've been in media 50 years now, 50. And the thing I do believe is, regardless of the platform, really interesting content, whether it's text, whether it's photography, whether it's audio, whether it's music, will perform. People want it. People will come to it.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll have more with y'all right after this.
Rapid expansion?
We're ready.
Worker shortage?
We're good.
Anything can change the world of work.
A celebrity buys the company.
Depends on who it is. But relax, we've got ADP.
From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
Hi, this is Paul Gigot, host of the Potomac Watch podcast. Join me and my colleagues every week as we dissect all of the latest happenings in Washington. Check us out at wsj.com/podcasts and become a subscriber on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and the Google Play Music app.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, back to the show.
All right, we're back. So NPR obviously looks different than some of the media competition in the space, public. And every few years, there are always these stories that prop up, pressure from Congress about, you know, federal funding of NPR. And you probably realize we just had an election. And
I missed that.
Yeah, we have a new president-elect who, it would seem, this hasn't really been in the news, but is there sort of fear that the new Trump administration might take a look at federal funding for NPR? I mean, he's got a Republican Congress. Is this something that you guys think about?
We think about it all the time, but not necessarily related to this election specifically. It's always an issue, and it's always something that we're concerned about. Federal funding for public radio is hugely important to us. The money doesn't come to us. There is a mythology. A lot of people don't know this. NPR, we as an entity, I get less than – we get a percent and a half of our budget from the federal government, which is a real shocker. However, our member stations all across the country do get money from the government. In total, it's about $110 million to the stations. The thing – and the reason we're concerned about it is in the larger cities, whether it's here in New York, someone like our member station WNYC – or my alma mater in L.A., KPCC, or WBUR in Boston, that federal money may account for, let's say, 3 or 4% of their budget. So if it were to go away, it would be a nuisance. It would be a pain. It wouldn't be irreparable. They would find a way to make it through. Here's the problem. Many small communities across the country, really the small markets, many of which I visited, Abilene, Texas, Lawton, Oklahoma, Flagstaff, Arizona, the percentage of the money that they get, although it's smaller dollars, it represents a much bigger percentage of their budget. It might be 30%. It might be 35%. That is, and those stations may be the only source of news and information on the radio in those communities. They're the ones that I worry about. So, yes, we're always concerned, but we're concerned about it at all times. We've had a Republican Congress since 2010. We have some great friends and supporters that are Republicans in the House and the Senate. And so we're always concerned, but we think we've got a wonderful story, and we're working hard and keeping our fingers crossed.
What's your take on something that's sort of been talked about a lot in the media lately is sort of the rise of fake news. And I guess, you know, obviously we just had an election. NPR is often cited as one of the most sort of reliable news sources out there. So what does that mean for sort of publicly funded news? Do you think there's sort of an appetite for this content more than there ever has been? Or
I do. I really do. And I appreciate you asking that question. This whole prevalence of fake news, and there's been much written about it lately, it's really a sad commentary. We think we're an antidote to that. That perception that we are and the reality that we're providing really solid fact-based journalism is really important to who we are as a brand and our public service mission. And fake news is part of it, but there's also even news that is real but just headlines or, you know, 140 characters. Some people want to get their news that way. We really think our place in the food chain is to do the opposite. And the more in-depth we do, the more analysis we do, the more context we try to provide. What does this mean? What's the historical precedent? We think that's really valuable. And as the world gets shorter in terms of its attention span, what were we talking about? More sensationalistic, if you will, or ideological, we think more and more people, not everybody, we're not going to be for everybody, but a lot of people are going to gravitate to that because it's different and there are fewer and fewer places that you can get that.
What do you see as the future of NPR News? Because like many legacy businesses, there has been through the years, you know, some turmoil and the news business at large struggles. Do you see that going forward as, you know, a real investment that you guys are going to make, or are you sort of, prioritizing other pockets of the business more?
It's our mission. It is our primary mission. We are committed to it. We think we have, and you're right, economically, news organizations, journalists, they not only have they have huge economic issues that they're facing. We actually think we've got a fabulous business model. Historically, NPR perhaps has not, well, not perhaps, hasn't optimized it as well as they should have. And that's one of the things I hope, you know, this current management team we have is going to be able to do. But we have three sources of revenue. We have our corporate sponsorship or underwriting. That's one. A lot of journalistic organizations have that. Those are the big powerhouses and the pillars of public broadcasting. So theoretically, yes, they don't have to buy that. They can say, yeah, we just want to buy. Wait, don't tell me. I can't imagine anybody doing that, but right. They could. So it is a la carte to that extent. What typically happens, though, is they'll buy the news magazines, and then pretty much everything else is a la carte.
So talk about how your business has changed. You mentioned underwriting. It seems like that you can call it a lot of different things sort of in the modern media space, like things like, you know, brought to you by or have sponsored content. Mm-hmm. Is that an area of your business that you are trying to grow, the sort of branded content, sponsored content, like a lot of media companies are these days?
We don't do that. We are very careful. We think a lot of our colleagues do it. But we think, back to the question you asked, Jack, about the credibility, we think that might put our brand at risk. And we can experiment with a lot of things. We love to experiment with things. We think innovation and trying things is important. And we know when we innovate and when we try things, many of them will fail. That's the price one pays. We don't want to do anything in the experimental field or innovative field that is going to put the brand at risk. It's not to say we would never, ever do that. But we need to. We are watching other institutions that are doing it. I am not a fan of that. There are some people that have done it and done it remarkably well. We may someday. I think it's going to be a while.
You think that sort of blurs the lines a little bit for listeners and readers?
I think it does, and particularly ours. We have a really unique brand of listener and consumer, and they're very careful and they listen very carefully, and they don't want us to have the slightest tinge of being affected by who our corporate sponsors are, or who our institutional foundations are that support us. They're always, you know, our audience questions everything, and so we don't want to give them any reason to be more concerned than they might already be.
So do you think what you do is sort of fundamentally different on that front versus some sort of digital media companies, for example, in terms of, you know, this content is brought to you by brand X, Y, or Z? Or?
Well, we do sponsorship. We might not use that exact language, but we do have corporate sponsors that do pay for and underwrite. But the difference between – perhaps I misunderstood the question. There's a big difference between branded
content.
Well,
there's content. A spectrum here, I guess.
Yes.
You know,
but we do – it is sponsorship. It's support for NPR comes from, and it can be anybody. I was just in Indianapolis earlier this week, and this is top of mind, Angie's List. And they help pay for, you know, the programming we produce. But none of our corporate sponsors, none of them say, hey, why don't you do something about this?
Right.
Or why don't you
right.
create this content for us? and we'll give you money. We don't do that.
We talk a lot on this podcast about media companies' relationships with some of the big platforms, Facebook, Google, you know, increasingly Snapchat. A lot of, you know, particularly Facebook, media companies have pinned their hopes on, you know, the rise of things like Facebook Video. I know that's something that NPR experiments with, but I'm curious, do you feel as though you're maybe less reliant than other media companies on newer platforms? And how do you think about things like Facebook Live, Snapchat, some of these newer platforms that I'm sure, you know, you want to be on to reach your desired audience, but that, you know, are causing fear among media executives often?
Well, we're not really fearful of them. I really see all of those platforms as a really interesting way for us to connect with people and have people be exposed to and try our content maybe for the first time or get used to it. I think one of the pieces of data we see from lots and lots of media companies is they may be sampled, you know, occasionally through somebody posting an article from a magazine or another media company. What our hope is, and we don't know whether ultimately this plays out or not, we get a lot of traffic. Facebook, in terms of our the social platforms, is far and away the number one. I think something like 45% of the social traffic we get comes from Facebook. The number two is Twitter, and it's 3%, and then everything else is under 1%. I mean, it's a significant number. We get a lot of people that come in from, you know, typing in the NPR.org URL or, you know, entering a story that they want to know more about or going on to, and, you know, there are lots of ways they get to. But a good portion of our traffic comes from Facebook. I think it's a way for them to get exposed to our brand, what we do, the way we create content, what we do that's very, very different than other people. And we hope that then they want to try our podcast. They want to try listening to Morning Edition or All Things Considered. Who knows? But we can't be fearful of these things, I don't think. I think we have to find a way. They're real. They're massive distribution. What's the best way for us to work with them? And so we've gotten really great relationships. We're playing around with Facebook Live. We don't know whether, you know, ultimately that's a good thing or a bad thing for us, but we're playing with it. We're having fun with it. We're doing things with Google. We're in the connected car with Apple and with Google. We're on the Apple Watch. We're on Alexa, you know, and on the Echo, and we're on the Google Home. We're on Google Home's platform. All these things are really interesting. Some will take off, some won't. But we want to be on every single one of them.
To what extent are you investing in video more generally as well? I mean, you mentioned Facebook Live. You know, I'm a big fan of the Tiny Desk videos that you do as well. Sort of an opportunity for you guys? You
think? It probably is. I think it has to be in keeping with who we are. Historically, we've defined ourselves as an audio storytelling company. We do podcasts. We do network radio. And we started doing Tiny Desk. And those videos, I think, are terrific. And what a really fun idea. And yeah, I think it's been a remarkable success. It just started out as an experiment, and it turned into something really remarkable. And so now the visuals team, we have a group of people, the visuals team who do the Tiny Desk, they've been doing some news stuff. Steve Inskeep's been interviewing President Obama. He's done it a number of times. I think he's doing it today. The visuals team that does the Tiny Desk concerts are the people that are shooting it. And if you've seen it, I don't know if you've seen it, but the interviews that Steve does with Paul Ryan or Barack Obama look different than they would if you were watching network television. They have a very distinctive look. We hope will ultimately be the NPR look. So we're playing around with these things. We think there's something there. We don't know where it's going to lead.
We mentioned this earlier. Obviously, your old haunt, MTV. You had some experience in the cable business. We talk a lot about that on this podcast. And as someone who used to be a cable executive and is, I'm sure, observing the changes in that industry, what has that been like? I mean, you've been described as a turnaround specialist before. If you had to go back into the cable industry now, where do you think the future is there, and what sort of bets would you be making if you were, you know, at the helm of an MTV?
Well, I'm always careful not to provide that kind of advice, and the reason is. I don't really have the facts at my fingertips, and people love to criticize other organizations. They go, well, you know, well, if I was running the place, this is what I would do. And I think it's I don't have access to that information. I don't know what they know. I think all of these organizations are run by really creative, smart people, and so I don't want to second guess them. I do think just I'll speak generally. The solution to any one of these problems, whether it's that organization and MTV or any other, I think is great content and being creative and being innovative. And the greatest moments that MTV has had historically, or E has had, or VH1, you know, companies I've worked for, or NPR, have been those moments of great creativity, experimenting with things, whether it's, you know, creating Tiny Desk or creating podcasts or creating a new show. And they're hard to plan. I mean, and a business person can't come up with those ideas, generally speaking. It's going to be a producer, someone that comes into the office. And one of my favorite MTV stories years ago, Ted Demme, who was a production assistant, he was young. He came and he started pounding the desk and saying, you know, I want to do a special on rap music. And we'd been playing some rap videos on MTV, but he says, there's something going on, we got to do it. And I said, go ahead and do a half-hour special. And he created Yo MTV Raps. And we didn't have any promotion, any marketing. Put that thing on the air. He and a guy named Peter Daugherty, both of them sadly have passed. It's sad. But they came in, and the first week, it was a smash success. Can you do another one next week? They go, sure. So they did another half hour. I said, could you do an hour a week? They said, sure. So then I said, hey, can you do a half hour a day? They go, sure. And ultimately became an hour daily show. We ran it three times a day, and it was a monster hit. And the only reason it happened was someone, a really great creative guy, came into my office and basically almost threw me against the wall and said, we have to do this. And I didn't want to get hit, so I said yes.
And the rest is history.
Yes.
One other thing I wanted to ask, we obviously talked about podcasts earlier. We've reported and talked about sort of the larger maybe struggles in the podcast ad market. It's growing extremely fast, but most of the ads for podcasts are direct response and, you know, the Squarespaces, the Caspers, whatever. And there's this perception, at least in some of the big marketers and ad buyers that I've talked to, that you know, it's not necessarily proven as a branding vehicle yet. So you're not necessarily going to hear a ton of ads for big cars or sort of the big brands. Do you think that that's going to change, or what do you think podcasting as a medium needs to do to really up it where they can secure more from big brand budgets that they have and put it?
I think it will change. I think podcasting is a remarkable way to reach people. I think it's a self-selected sample of people. It's an unusual group of people, regardless of whether it's one of ours.
Our listeners are unusual.
In a good way. I mean, in a really good way. But these are people that are seeking out. Think about it. What you have to do. It's not really for us. We're used to doing it, right? And it's easy. But I think for a lot of people, it's like what people that haven't. You know, the 80% that aren't listening every month. I do think there are a couple of things going on, and the same thing happened back, you know, kind of the beginning of the web and people creating blogs. Everybody had to have one, and now podcast, everybody has one. Guy Raz told me the other day, he said he heard the number that there were 320,000 weekly podcasts. It's a crazy number. Most of them are not any good. Most of them will get any traction. But there are some remarkable people across the universe doing this great stuff. So I think a couple of things happen. The pie gets bigger. I love the fact that there's so many great people making podcasts. You know, some people are very provincial. Aren't you afraid you're going to lose market share? Well, we're trying to grow a pie. I'd rather have a smaller percentage of a much, much bigger pie, something that's really healthy with a lot of people who are 90% of the population are listening to podcasts, and we've got a great measurement tool that, you know, packaged goods and automobiles and all the major sponsors can use to buy sponsorship or underwriting or advertising on. So I think it's going to go that way. It's happened with almost every – I remember the, you know – it's kind of sound like a really old, old guy. I remember the early days of the internet. I was on the board of CNET, and those executives were deeply involved with the Interactive Advertising Bureau. And I remember the days when the dollars going to web advertising were like really, really small. It was like, you know, someday there's going to be a universal measurement tool, and someday there's going to be, you know, a universal way of the ads being programmed. And it did. And of course, you know, we know how much money is spent, you know, on those platforms these days. I think the same thing's going to happen. The content's too good. There's such great content everywhere.
What's your dealing like with Apple? Because so much consumption of podcasts come through the Apple app, and it's been written before, but it seems like they have a sort of passing interest in podcasting. They obviously like helped the name podcast. You know, they helped give it that name, but it seems like it's not something that they're really interested in cashing in on necessarily right now, but they must have so much data. I know that they're not necessarily the most forthcoming all the time with that data. So what is it like being sort of a big podcast producer and dealing with them, I'm sure, on like a daily basis?
Well, they're great partners for us on a lot of things. They reach so many people, their devices. We know this is now and is going more and more to being a smartphone world where we're consuming so much of what we consume media-wise, whether it's music, podcasts, news, text, video, photography. So they're remarkable partners, and we're on the Apple Watch. We're going to be in, you know, their Apple Connect for the cars. We're trying to be everywhere that Apple is and what they're experimenting with. We love working with them. They are, as you know, the number one distributor or number one platform for the distribution of podcast content. The reason they have not been forthcoming with data is their concerns about privacy. And I've had conversations with Tim Cook. It's great. He's a huge NPR fan, which we're very happy about. They love the partnership with us, and we hope to do more. We are trying to find a way to get access to that data in a way that doesn't violate any of their principles about privacy. That said, there are other ways we are going to be distributing the content where we can get access to that data because, as you guys know, the more we know about who's listening, the better a job we're going to be able to monetize it. The more money that comes into the system, it funds better and more interesting and more unique content for you, for us, for everybody in the sector. So, and it makes it much more sustainable. And back to the previous question, I think it's going to happen. And I think a lot, you know, who knows 30 years down the road, what kind of really great, cool stuff is going to come.
Well, we'll have you back on in 30 years and we'll see if these predictions.
They'll wheel me in. I do plan to be here in 30 years.
Same. Y'all, thanks so much for joining us.
This is great fun. Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll catch you next time on the WSJ Media Mix Podcast.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.